Everybody, welcome. It is May 5th, Cinco de Mayo, 2026. If you are in the Bay Area, this afternoon and this evening, there will be at least one, if not more, monks. From the Abhayagiri Monastery in Berkeley at the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery. They show up for tea time at 5, and then they have an evening program at 7:30. I will be attending the tea, at least. At least that is my plan. I don't like to make too many predictions about the future, as things are uncertain. I was just listening to, thanks to Paula for the recommendation of the Ajahn Chah book. I was just listening to that as I walked up the hill from dropping off my car for some service, and he was talking a lot about it, things are uncertain, and that's a phrase I think in Thai it's something like "mine," and which I'm terrible, I'm sure the worst pronunciation, but Ajahn Pasno often uses that term, things are uncertain, and it was something. Ajahn Chah would say, instead of saying things are impermanent, or in addition to saying things are impermanent, in any case, things are uncertain. It is uncertain whether I will go to the monastery this afternoon. Okay, that's enough chatter. Suddenly can't hear Kevin. I am sorry about that, but you're really not missing much. So just look at the screen and, meditate. Okay, I guess if you can't hear me, you didn't hear me say that, so sorry. I was going to say read my lips, but then it was, a whole thing that goes along with that. We don't want to go there. Okay, let's meditate. Okay, Mimi, excellent. If you choose to close your eyes, that's a nice way to meditate. If you're not comfortable with that, or if you prefer, you're welcome to sit with your eyes open. I recommend not looking at the screen, though. There's no real need for that. And this gives you a little break from screens, which I think we all know we spend a little more time on screens than perhaps is ideal for our mental and probably physical health. And so, as we turn away from the visual world, we turn toward the inner world, the felt world, and the mental world. I'm beginning by just feeling whatever mood is present for you, whatever kind of feeling or mind state. How are you feeling at this time, whether it is morning or another time, depending on your locale? So checking in with where you're starting your meditation can be helpful, so that we understand where our meditation goes and perhaps what it needs. If you are feeling anxious, for instance, you might want to start with the calming practice, a little deeper breathing, and maybe a concentration practice like breath counting, just trying to release energy. If you're drowsy, you might want to sit more upright or open the eyes. And again, the breath can also work as an energizing force. If we kind of lean into that. If there is some worry or concern on your mind, just acknowledge that. It's not unusual to find in the midst of a meditation that you're thinking about something that was kind of underlying your mood. Maybe you didn't realize it was there until things got quiet. And connecting with the breath, something to focus the mind, to ground the energy. There's a kind of softening that comes as the mind engages with the breath. Letting the body settle. It's not that we're trying to attain some state or fix ourselves. Rather, to be in an attitude of acceptance, of openness, of observing. Things are as they are right now. Might be pleasant, might be unpleasant, might be just a kind of neutral state. We don't have to do anything about any of that. It's this attitude of acceptance, openness, equanimity that allows us to be present without trying to control, without grasping, rejecting. If thoughts arise, we don't have to push them away or judge them or judge ourselves. The simplest response is to notice and then turn the attention back to the breath. It can also be useful to notice the content of thoughts, just to see what the habitual patterns or concerns are, the things that arise in the space of meditation. We might learn something about ourselves that we didn't quite see or didn't fully understand. If you can, attune to the subtle energies in the body. These aren't exactly sensations in the typical sense of touching something. But rather, the ongoing energy of the nervous system. When these inner sensations get strong, we tend to call them emotions. When they aren't strong, we tend to ignore them. And feeling this flow of energy in the body, feeling the body as energy, is a way of changing our perspective on who and what we are. This then can bring about a shift in perception. Instead of feeling the body as a thing, as an object, as a solid existence, it's felt as a flow, a non-static flow of energy. All right. So, Kathy, you said step five. Was there some reason you wanted to hear about that in particular, or was it just?
No, it's okay. I found your book on Kindle,
Oh,
so
okay. Well, I mean, sure, good. All right. So now I
anything
don't
you
have to.
want. Actually,
Thank you.
that's wonderful. I can highlight and cut and paste, and I love it. So thank you so much. I might have to retire my well-worn copy that I carry with me. So anything you want to talk about, and if anybody wants, is fine. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Does somebody have their hand up that I don't see, John? Oh, it's because you got it such a pale hand there. Yeah, that's why it
That's true.
fades into your wall
It
back there.
is. So during a meditation, you talked about energy and, could to f see if we could sense energy. And I started to think about it, which is antithesis of purpose of
Well,
meditation. But
not
in a
necessarily.
sense, yeah, I hear. So I couldn't. I couldn't get anything, which would speak to a lot of reasons. But I'm curious if you would just talk a little more about it and maybe some examples. I kind of sensed maybe some things, and I started thinking, well, there's certainly energy going into my brain when I start thinking, right? There's some sort of nerve force or something that's creating these thoughts that I have to remember to go back to breathing. But just your clarification or examples, or I don't know. And I know it's going to be
Yeah,
different for you than it is.
no, I appreciate the question. I think because I understand that when I'm saying that, because my own experience is that it's not something that you can immediately tune into just because somebody says, "Oh, just feel this." It's kind of like working with qi, with qigong, right? You're kind of like you're moving your arms, but are you actually feeling anything? So the first of all, to attune on this at this level, there does need to be a certain, I think, at least initially, in order to kind of find it, there needs to be a certain level of concentration or calm, because our ordinary mind states are dominated by our thinking mind, and the anxieties and emotions that go along with our thinking. And so I kind of think of that as like the surface of the of mental experience, of what we can experience in the mind, and that's pretty easy to bring awareness to when you sit down to meditate. Pretty quickly you're like, oh, like I'm thinking, I'm not paying attention to my breath or whatever I'm trying to pay attention to, and then you go off and you're thinking for like 10 minutes and you realize, whoa, I've been just spacing out the whole time. And that's just because, well, that's what humans do, and there's reasons for it, and certainly in terms of evolution that we're thinking in order to stay safe. It's a protective mechanism, essentially, like watch out for danger and find pleasure, or find food or something. So that we need to practice enough to get that surface energy to quiet down a little bit so that we can start to detect the subtler energies, as I call them, because I think they are energies. I mean, the nervous system is an electrical system, as I understand it. I mean, there's there's chemical stuff that goes on, but and so electrochemical. I mean, I'm not at all a scientist, and I don't get. I'm not all that interested in the technology of it all. But it's an important stage of practice, and one I certainly want to point people toward. First of all, because when we're not aware of those experiences, and it's hard to call them, anything specific. If I call them sensations, I feel like that, as I kind of refer to, and it's not, they're not quite sensations, because sensations typically we think of as things that occur on the surface of the body, or as internal, things like digestion or some, stomach ache or headache. So those are sensations that these energies are felt, and they appear the same way as sensations. So I suppose we can call them that. But the point I'm trying to get to is that these, okay, we'll call them sensations, these energetic sensations are what are often interpreted as emotions. In other words, we give them meaning that they don't necessarily have, or they could be related to that meaning. But a lot of the meaning we give to them, the meaning we give to them is very conditioned. That is to say, we develop a habitual way of understanding what we're feeling. So, I can only speak from my own experience to kind of encapsulate this. That, and I tell this story, and I've written it a few times recently, and kind of working into different things I'm writing about starting to feel some discomfort, some pain. When I was 14, that I immediately identified as and named as depression. And that naming itself then created and started to build this narrative about who I was and what my emotional states were. And it reified them, made them solid. And when I look at those states now, because those very similar, I can't say they're the same states arise now, because it's, not the same time, but when similar states arise now, I see that they are just f unpleasant feelings, or now that's how I interpret them. Now that's how I understand them. And I know that they, and so that they influenced my thinking. They influenced, like I was talking about, like this morning, it was before the recording started. Oh, it's kind of crummy weather, and I'm kind of like, I'm not really into whatever, I don't feel really sharp. And that's just like a passing state now. But when I was 14, I took it as like, well, I'm depressed. And what does that feeling tell me, right? The feeling tells me, you can't do anything about this because it's just a thing, which is, again, wrong view. It's not a thing. But the feeling tells me it's a solid thing, and that what it's saying is you can't, don't bother with pretty much everything. Like, school sucks, life sucks, you can't, you're an unhappy person. And so you got to find his escape. And, presumably everybody here at some point in their life had some kind of feeling that told them, you got to find an escape. Because that's what we did. So my escape was music, drugs, alcohol, and sex, I don't even like to say sex, because it was like, it was, being fixed by, relationships or something. So all of that then is just an unwholesome, an unwise response to an unpleasant feeling, which, when sensed, this one person keeps coming in and then getting bumped out, I guess. When sensed on just this felt level, is just energy. So, and so it's really, this is for me the essence of my later life practice, And really, it goes back to early in my practice, but I didn't know how to do it for a long time. And I was looking for something. I found something. I will put this little article in the tech. It's an interview with the late Dharma teacher Robert Hall, who was one of the Spirit Rock founders. And in it, I quoted him in something I was writing. I will try to find it. I was just looking at it a little while ago. Okay. He says, he's talking about, well, I'm just going to read what I quoted because he says, it's always a bodily experience, one that involves paying attention to sensations. And this here he talks about now the stages of meditation as the mind gets more stabilized. At some point, the body starts to become formless and we are no longer doing emotional work. The body becomes a field, an energy field, and we connect to the universal nature of the experience. We have moved out of the work of psychology and into the spiritual realm. So this is just, he's just describing a meditative state. The body becomes formless. So your eyes are closed, and at a certain point, you're not feeling your body as like this, arms, shoulders, legs, stomach. You're feeling, because your eyes are closed, you're not seeing it. You're just feeling the body as a field of energy. And that's not an inaccurate description of what the body is. The body is also these limbs and, parts. But on another level, it's also just energy, right? Because it's just atoms that are energy. And so there's a real value in cultivating your meditation to the point where you can connect with this and then take that connection into your daily life. So in those moments when you feel like you're getting swept away, you can stop and go, and this is where we go, breathe and go, oh, what am I actually feeling, as opposed to what my head is telling me, the words, the thoughts, the judgments that are appearing in my mind, like, oh God, what's going on? It's like, oh, this is an unpleasant feeling when sensed. And the reason that I use that the word energy is useful here is because when sensed, it is not something stable or solid. The word energy implies something in motion. This is the critical idea, right? This is what the Buddha talking about impermanence is talking about. He's not just talking about, oh, you get born, you die, you buy a new car, it gets scratched. No, like the immediacy of impermanence is this sense of the mind-body experience as just a flow of energy. And it's a huge shift. I'm looking at this screen of all these faces, and all of you have bodies, right? And it's hard to think of our body as something that isn't solid. But this is, as you meditate, I don't know that you can force this, but just keep breathing and releasing the story and attuning to this felt experience. I mean, certainly it took me a while to get there to feel it. So that I don't expect that just because I'm giving a talk and describing this that everybody here is going to be like, oh yeah, good, I got that. I mean, this is why we train the mind. And it's one of those things that, again, I tend to say this a lot. I don't think we hear a lot of teachers pointing us toward this. I don't know. I don't listen to other teachers very much anymore, so maybe they do. But sorry, love them. They're all great. But meditation is, it's sort of like sold and marketed as all these things, right? As oh, get calm and get healthy and lower your blood pressure but when it's talking about, particularly about healing emotions, and all of it does come down to a shift in perspective to seeing something that we don't ordinarily see. So part of that is training the mind to be stable enough, to be quiet enough that you can pick out this subtler experience. I was talking on Sunday for the Buddhist Recovery Network about the inner sound, the sound of silence that Sumedho talks about, Ajahn Sumedho. And it's the same thing. It's just the audio version of the energetic field. And it might be easier to pick that up. But it doesn't, the thing about the audio version is that it doesn't have this connection to the emotional state that I sense. It's more of a concentration object, but it has the same quality in terms of just being a flow of energy and a flow of apparent sound. So, anyone else want to say anything?
I'll chime in, Kevin. Debbie,
Okay, thanks, Deb.
I don't know if I'm on the screen or not.
You are. I see you.
I really appreciated this meditation, recognizing my habit patterns. I tend, that bell rings, or that invitation to meditate rings or comes out, and it just settle, right? My body just settles. I just go into this place. And so my tendency is to become very calm and very easeful. And so often over time that leads me into the head nod or the body twitch or whatever. And so just your prompt about noticing what the energy is, I thought, okay, I'm going to do something different today and just kind of lift my energy up a little bit. So deeper inhales, that's my go-to. Bigger inhales to fill this body, with that aware energy. But the funny thing was, not the funny thing, whatever. My mind
Gotcha.
said, oh, yay, energy's up, body's up. There's this shift of energy, and my mind wanted to go run with it. So I noticed my mind today was very, started tending towards very much busyness of planning and thinking. And so if I sense into that, I could sense what is the emotion under that. And I didn't think about what that emotion was until after, while you've been talking. And I noticed my emotion is concern, concern to get it done, to be on top, to make sure, whatever. But in the moment, I just laughed. I laughed at myself. It was like, oh, look at you, silly mind. Give you an inch of energy and you take a mile. And so I was able, for me, the practice became being aware, noticing, and recognizing that sometimes the mind leads, sometimes the body leads, but I don't have to get stuck in either one. And I can just notice what that flow is, and then invite myself back to that, I guess you'd say, the middle way. This middle kind of balancing point of energy, but just recognizing how the mind and body can actually kind of play with itself, right? And noticing where I am. I don't know, I just felt compelled to share that because it was kind of a fun practice. A more awake energy of contemplation and observation and feeling. So there it is.
Thank you. Yeah, that's great.
I don't know if that's helpful to anybody or not. It doesn't matter. It's just my experience.
Well, I do think that, you're also a meditation teacher, and a lot of what we're doing is just pointing out some of the places people can look, because what's interesting, and I think this was maybe a little bit underneath what you're saying. Once you've had a clear seeing of some of these states, some of these energies, some of these experiences, they become more accessible. So that I had to go on retreat probably a few times to get to a place where I could attune to the subtler states. But now, to some degree, I can pick those up in ordinary daily meditation, where I'm not concentrated by any means, but it's like, the pictures where they, I don't know what the term is, where it's like there's two things that can be seen, right? The woman's head and the peacock or whatever. And like, once you see them both, you're able to see them both. But up until then, you only see one. But once you see them both, it's easy for you to see them both. And it's much like that. We get attuned and start to pick up these different aspects of experience, and then they become much more obvious to us. And this is I think, a common result of mindfulness meditation in general. That when people start to become mindful, all of a sudden they're like, oh, all this stuff was here all the time. I just didn't notice it before. I just wasn't paying attention in this way. I think it's useful, for what you share for people to realize, oh, right, there's these different things. I can find them for myself. Gabrielle, I see your physical hand waving.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin. I'm sorry, I can't find my
That's okay. I know.
virtual hand.
Well, Zoom keeps changing too, which is really unacceptable. They should really stay the same all the time. But anyway, go on.
We won't go there. Everything changes, as you've heard.
Right, that was the
Anyway,
problem. Yes.
I so appreciate the topic today. I was privileged to be able to attend your BNR thing on Sunday, which was really wonderful too. And the meditation and the talk today were great. My issue, one reason for my addiction, starting when I was around 14 too, was an inability to be truthful with myself. So when I finally was able to say, I am an al addict, I am an alcoholic, that was really, really an important step in my recovery. The more I got into meditation and everything, I came to not want to be caught in the stories I tell myself. So I don't want to be attached to that identity. So there's this, insidious, cunning, baffling problem with addiction and alcoholism that craving is still with me after, a long time, 37 years or something of sobriety. It still comes up. My husband smokes weed, and it's really hard for me. And I stay away from it and everything, but the craving, the smell, I mean, it just is triggering all the time, all the time.
Ouch.
So if I don't say, keep in mind that I'm an addict, then it's dangerous for me. And so I feel like I'm in this vicious circle. I don't want to be attached to that story. And yet, round and round we go. So, yeah.
Well, so I mean, this comes up fairly regularly, this question of identity as an addict in relation to the Buddhist teachings on not self. Where I come down is, let's not turn Buddhist teachings into a belief system, or indeed even worse, a kind of sin model that, oh, I'm identifying as an alcoholic, it's a sin, but rather ask ourselves, what is creating or leading to suffering, and what is creating or leading to the end of suffering? Because that's the question. We're not trying to live up to some model of Buddhist political correctness, spiritual correctness. And so for me, and it sounds like for you, I find it useful to call myself an addict and an alcoholic. I don't feel suffering around that. I know that some people absolutely do, and usually because they feel some shame around it. I feel zero shame around it, thank you. I just don't. Admitting I was an alcoholic before I admitted I was an alcoholic, and again, I'll put aside whether I am an alcoholic. I don't care whether I'm an alcoholic or not. I've never been diagnosed. I was never treated. Like, who knows? It doesn't matter. It's helpful for me, but before that, it seemed like a terrible thing, right? And this is, I'm sure many of you, if not all of you, are familiar with this issue. When you're in the midst of your addictive behavior, the idea of saying that you're an addict just is like really ter like, oh God. And that was there was this idea of shame, but shockingly for me, as soon as I was like, yeah, I guess I'm an alcoholic, I'm an addict, whatever. That all fell away, and I was like, oh, what a relief. It was like, okay, that was very clear. What was causing suffering was resisting saying I was an alcoholic. What relieved suffering was saying I was an alcoholic. And more importantly, of course, living as a sober person, taking on the commitment to live sober. And so it's not an issue for me, right? I don't care about being spiritually correct and, oh God, you're not supposed to say, and people who get into that, it looks to me like just a more subtle and sophisticated way of staying in denial. It's like a very cool Buddhist way of like being able to keep drinking. Because like I wouldn't want to identify as an alcoholic. Like that would just be like not Buddhist. Like I don't care. I'm not trying. I don't care about being a Buddhist. I'm not trying to be Buddhist. Buddhists are annoying to me. I mean those other Buddhists. I like alcoholics and addicts. I think they're much more fun than Buddhists. So. Steve Jones. I'm sorry, I said your name. I
Quite all
broke
right.
your anonymity.
I don't care who knows my first and last name, never have.
Okay.
You just
I
really
didn't
touched,
think you did, but I
no,
just.
not at all. You just touched on something that really struck a chord with me. I've been spending more time listening than talking, which is rare for me, but
That is rare for you.
yeah, I've experienced quite a shift in my life.
I'm teasing you,
Yeah, I know you do.
and I love you.
I can tell you the shame that I feel as a food addict, because that's something I have to deal with two or three times a day. And I'm still suffering from cravings for the food. And whenever I fall into that, I just feel so much shame around the fact that I can't seem to get a handle on it. And it's how I sedate myself because of the pain I'm experiencing in the world. But I can share with you, I've been off of pain meds now for almost 3 months, and I was able to release the narcotics. And I know that that was something that I'd talked to you about, but that I have no shame around being a drug addict or an alcoholic. I don't. I could give a shit. But when it comes to the food, it's been with me since I was 5, 6 years old, and I'm going to be 75. And I still feel that shame when I don't feel that I can control. When I start eating something that I shouldn't be eating, I just can't seem to stop. And I know that it's a way to sedate myself because I'm feeling so much, I don't know, I'm experiencing a lot of synchronicity in my life right now. I've been doing a tremendous amount of work, and my meditation practice is just really expanding. So thank you for bringing that up, because it's very powerful, very, very powerful. And anyway, thanks.
Thanks, Steve. And I really appreciate you bringing up the food question as well, just because it's clearly not the same as drugs and alcohol, just for the very reason that you said, that you have to take your drug of choice multiple times a day. And if I had to, like, if I was prescribed marijuana, it'd be hard for me. I wouldn't feel good about it. And I'd be really frustrated about going into these states, and then I would get very attached to the state. It would be just really hard. So I don't feel like quite the same with the alcohol. I'm not sure you get prescribed it. But anyway, nothing comes to mind except thank you for sharing about that. And just a reminder for all of us that there are different forms of addiction that that have particular challenges wrapped up with them. And I think the ones around relationships, sexuality, food, things that are, inescapable aspects of our human life that we can't just abstain from. They have special challenges that really require a lot of compassion, and a lot of kindness. And I think of harm reduction. This is where I think harm reduction is particularly useful. I'm not a big fan of harm reduction around drugs and alcohol, but around food and sex, I think they are. It's the better model. But anyway, that's just my opinion. I'm not a addiction professional.
It helps to talk about it, and I am seeing major improvements, and it's the hardest one. I've been through all the addictions. It's the hardest one by far, but I'm getting better, so thanks for sharing that.
Well, hell, and you're 75, so
You'd think something would happen.
you've
I
gone
eat
this
good
far.
food, I just eat too much.
All right. Well, on that happy note, I don't know if it's not an unhappy note, but anyway, let's see. This Friday, I'm doing the Spirit Rock Zoom at 6 o'clock, and th then the weekend of Memorial Day, I'll be in person with Vimalasara for I guess it starts on the Thursday before Memorial Day, to retreat at Big Bear Retreat Center. If you're interested in sitting and some silent practice and some engaged practice. Other than that, I will be back here next Tuesday. My nay. It's uncertain, but that is the plan. Take care,
Namaste.
everybody.
Thank
Thank
you,
you.
Kevin.
Thanks.
Thanks, Kevin. Appreciate it today.
Thank you,
Oh,
Kevin.